That sounds like Law and Order to me, Ray Larson.
Damn right.
That's the second time today you've said that. Right. Since you turned 70, you're getting kind of surly.
Raunchy.
Yeah.
Raunchy,
yeah. Good morning. Welcome into the 9 to 10 show. And it is a Forensic Friday. And we have a cast of four this morning in the studio. Brought to you by Landscaper's Corner, 1305 Old Frankfort Pike. Largest selection of natural stone in our area. Call them at 225-9433. The Kentucky District District Attorneys Association. Is that what it's called?
How about Kentucky Prosecutors Conference?
Going on, that's what I said. Yeah. Going on in Lexington today, and every year when this happens, you bring some of your folks from around the state who do what you do in different jurisdictions.
And better. They do it better.
And you've brought the three guests with you this morning. Two we know very well, and one is new for us.
Right.
Please introduce us to our guests.
Well, we know Chris Coron from Bowling Green.
Yep.
And
morning, Chris.
Morning, Jack.
And we know Jackie Steele from London.
Sure. Good morning, Jackie.
And they're both going to have to get closer to that microphone.
Well, when they start really talking.
Right, sure. Right. And with us this time is Tom Wine, who is the newly elected Commonwealth's attorney in Jefferson County, that I like to call the most dangerous city in all of Kentucky.
Which you appreciate, I'm sure, Tom.
It's job security, Jack. Thank you.
Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you.
Tom has had an interesting career. He started out as a prosecutor and then retired and became a judge. And continued his retirement from the circuit bench to the Court of Appeals. And then he decided he probably ought to start working again. And
he
became a prosecutor. Right. Isn't that fair?
That's about right. I wouldn't say I retired as a prosecutor when I went to the bench, but because I was kind of young. I was only 36 and a half. Went to the circuit bench for 15 years and then went to the Court of Appeals for another five. Really enjoyed the trial work, and particularly as a prosecutor. So, as I tell people, I put away the black dress, put on a white hat, became a prosecutor again.
Well, that's right.
I like that. That's a big office you run up there. Tell us about the size.
We've got about 100 employees now. 48 of them are attorneys. We handle 4,000 indictments a year. The metro Louisville population is a little over a million. I got 750,000 in Jefferson County alone. But obviously, criminals don't respect boundaries. They cross over between counties all around us, and so we get a lot of action up there. Yes, sir.
Chris, you're from Bowling Green, and what we usually do on this is the annual BS session amongst prosecutors, mm-hmm. because we like to get people from around the state to talk about the kind of issues and crimes that they're facing in their community. And you're down there just above the Tennessee border in far southwestern Kentucky. By the way, Chris and I are going double or nothing on our bet. Western is in Bowling Green, and he's a Vanderbilt graduate. And so we went for a quarter on each of those football games last year, and he clobbered me.
Did
so
he?
We're going double or nothing on the Western game this year.
I look forward to collecting my dollar here shortly.
Good luck with that.
Not a chance.
Good luck with that.
Okay, Chris, tell us a little bit about what are you facing down in Bowling Green?
Really, one of the most concerning trends we have in Bowling Green is something that everybody in the state's having to start to deal with. As successful as the pill bill was, it really trying to stem the tide on prescription drug abuse, we've now seen heroin creep into South Central Kentucky. And Northern Kentucky, for quite a while now, has been inundated in heroin. Jefferson County's had a significant issue with it. I know Lexington started to, but we're now having to deal with heroin. It's cheap, it's plentiful, and most concerning, it's very deadly.
And it's for people who were hooked on pain pills that can't get them anymore,
basically,
right?
You get the same active ingredient from pills that you do from heroin. Highly addictive as an opiate. And highly deadly due to the fact that they really don't know what they're getting. So that's something that we're working hard on, both at the state level as well as locally. Like I said, in Northern Kentucky, the overdose rate is scary, to say the least.
We talked about this. We have an association, a Commonwealth Attorneys Association meeting after the presentations, educational presentations yesterday, And we start talking about the heroin issue because there is some proposal, we think, that Chris reported on to do something to increase the severity of the laws as it relates to heroin.
I think we're going to see a state statute come that's basically going to mirror a federal statute where if somebody is trafficking in heroin and thereby, by providing that drug, causes the overdose death of an individual, we'll be able to prosecute them also under a homicide statute. That's being done some in federal court now. Obviously, over 99% of the cases in the criminal justice system rest in state court and not federal court. I think this will be a good tool for our larger drug traffickers to try and stem this tide somewhat.
You know, I just saw this morning that Somerset, Pulaski County case was indicted in federal court for as a result of death of overdose death. Jackie, what's happening? What's happening down in London?
Well, I'm the little fish in a big pond up here with you guys, the bigger cities. But we have I've got two counties, Laurel and Knox County, and I pretty much image what Chris has said in that. Up to 6 months ago, I'd never seen a heroin case. And now I've got our first heroin case with several defendants coming from Northern Kentucky, Cincinnati area. They just pled guilty 3 weeks ago and been sentenced today, I believe. So and it's a growing trend. It's coming. My officers tell me it's out there. They're trying to get into the network and get it stopped and kind of figure out where it's coming from. But one of the other trends we've noticed is property crimes, burglaries, and thefts are dramatically increased in our jurisdiction, even to the point last month our bailiff looked at us after we got done returning indictments. He said, I've never seen that many theft cases and burglary cases before. Usually it's all methamphetamine in my neck of the woods, and that's slowed down some in drugs. But he said, I think we had four drug cases and the rest were burglary and theft receiving stolen property cases. So, and I know that's getting on Ray's soapbox a little bit. That's one of those issues that there is a victim the crime, it is, will never be compensated for what they've lost.
And we have a catch and release program in Kentucky, right?
Yeah, well, now that you mentioned that.
Yeah. Right into that.
Yeah. One of the real issues is that these property crimes are perceived as what our legislature thinks are nonviolent property crimes. And our criminal-friendly sentencing statutes encourage those people to be probated. Let me put them back on the street. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling you, since in the last 4 or 5 or 6 years, property crimes has gone from less than 80% of the crimes, Part 1 crimes that occur in Lexington, to 94%.
Wow, that's big.
And that's because these repeat property offenders, they're left on the street to do it.
How does the former judge feel about that?
You know, there's no question that property crimes are up, even in Louisville as well, and they are drug related. People who need to feed their habit need to spend money. They're not working, and so that's an issue. Mm-hmm. I take a little bit different stand though. Kentucky, until just a couple of years ago, had one of the fastest growing prison populations in the country, and we weren't resolving those issues. I would like to look at possibility of particularly first-time offenders, getting them into treatment, people who have drug issues, getting them into treatment. If that fails, then you drop the hammer. But, we have a lot of people, and this heroin problem, as I said, a lot of drug overdoses, because people don't know the purity of the product that they're dealing with. And heroin, when it was back, 30 and 40 years ago, is not sold the same way, not being used the same way. And so we have a lot of young people totally inexperienced that their first time is their last time. And that certainly is an issue. One of the problems that I see, too, in our area, more so in the urban areas than the rural, but it's everywhere, is human trafficking. And there is a real issue with people who are being brought into this country, as well as runaways, our own children who are runaways, who are being used in the sex trade business. And that's an issue that's been on the forefront with the American Bar Association. It's one in our office that we're looking at. There's been one federal prosecution. We've had one state prosecution out of Jefferson County that I'm aware of. I know there are several that have been indicted. You sell a pill or you sell a line of cocaine or you sell a bindle of heroin, that's a one-time sale. You take one of these young girls, 14, 15 years old, they can be sold again and again and again. And, Jack, there are some statistics out there that show some of these girls are being used 8 to 20 times a day, $50 to $100 each sex act that they're being used in. So that's an issue that we want to get ahead of in Kentucky. We don't want to be coming up behind on that.
All right, guys, if you can kind of share the headphones, I don't think you even have to put them on, but you kind of lean in there to listen. We've got a caller here. This is James. Good morning, James.
Hey, good morning. I got late on the conversation, but with the drug problem, I just had my battery store on my box truck, and someone said they were selling it for the, I guess there's a $10 fee that they're getting, and then somebody else said that they're getting the acid out of make drugs.
Getting the acid out of the battery to make drugs? Really? Is that right, Tom?
Meth.
Really?
Yeah. And then they can sell it. They can use, Tom shaking his head too, they can use the acid in the production of methamphetamine, and then they can also use the battery. We'll take it to a recycling center and get, he said $10. I wouldn't disagree with it. It's $5 or $10 for the battery because the contents of it they can recycle.
And $200 to $300 to get it fixed and make that cables and everything. So
we talked about that before where they cut the, mess up the air conditioning systems. And they may get $30, but the person, the poor person whose system they mess with may cost thousands to fix.
Right.
I appreciate the call, James. I didn't know that.
Thank you. I didn't either. Thanks.
We're going to take a break. 253-5959, touch *590 from AT&T. Toll free from anywhere, 1-877-777-0590, or email jackpatty@wvlkam.com. We are back. It's 26 minutes after 9. And if you have a question or comment for our prosecutors this morning, 253-5959. Touch *590 from AT&T, toll-free from anywhere, 1-877-777-0590, or email jackpatty@wvlkam.com. And I recommend to you, if you're going to go break the law, don't do it in Lexington, Louisville, London, or Bowling Green, because these guys will get you. Yeah. Ray? All right. Damn right. There you go. I'll say it for you.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we just heard some terms when we were off the air.
Yeah, very interesting.
And
yeah.
Let's what's a creeper, Chris?
Creepers are something that we're starting to see across the nation that everybody needs to be aware of. Next time you go fill up for gas and you're pumping your gas, make sure you lock your car. Because what will happen is while you're standing at the pump waiting for your car to fill up, creepers are people that will walk up to the passenger side of your vehicle, sneak in your car, steal anything they can get their hands on within a couple of seconds, and then before you even realize you've been robbed, they're gone.
And they get whatever's in there, sunglasses,
iPhone. Anything they can either pawn or sell on the street. Mm-hmm. And then obviously what do they do with that? They go buy dope with it.
Yeah.
Now that's creepers. Another nonviolent property.
Right. Correct. And tell us about the, Jackie, about the people that have those roller things that they use in mechanic shops
I call them a crawler. Mechanics have, they lay on, go underneath the car and work on them, so they lay on and then roll back out. We had a group come through our Walmart in London.
Were they from London?
We don't know, Ray. We got the video footage, but it was so far away, the Walmart security footage, we couldn't ID who it was. But literally went down a line. If you imagine Walmart, any Walmart in the nation, it's the same way. There's just cars piled on top of cars. Under one car to the other, and was cut, had a sawzall, and was cutting the catalytic converters out from underneath them. And then they take them to a recycling center and get $40-$50 for one of those because it's got platinum and some other titanium, I think, maybe some little good bit of gold in it. The problem is it costs about $1,000 to replace a catalytic converter on a vehicle. So another nonviolent property crime, as Ray Larson likes to say. So we've got a whole bunch of people at Walmart that are upset when they get out and they're.
Was it you that was saying in the break about the air conditioning? It was you. Yeah.
Chris,
tell us about that.
Another trend, unfortunately, we've seen, we'll have individuals that will go to businesses or residents, pop the back off of HVAC units, pull the copper tubing out of them.
And they're probably pretty good and efficient at it. Do it real quickly.
Pretty quick.
Yeah. You call them tweakers?
Tweakers. And the tweakers, in our area of the state, are methamphetamine addicts that are deemed tweakers. And it comes from the term that they will stay up for days and sometimes weeks at a time on a methamphetamine binge. Well, they'll pop off the backs of HVAC units, pull the copper tubing out of them, and then like with Jackie's case, the catalytic converter, they'll take them to recycling. We had a guy hit a street in one of our small towns in Warren County one night.
Which town?
Smiths Grove, Kentucky.
You said it looks like Mayberry.
It looks like Mayberry. Yeah. Just storefront, antique shops. Did about $70,000 in damage to net about $300 in recycled copper. Mm. Nonviolent property crime.
Nonviolent.
Now, I want to talk a little bit, if I can, about a violent kind of crime.
And okay. I tell you what we'll do. Before we get into it, it's time to take a break almost. Okay. Let's go and take the break, and we'll be right back. Attorney Ray Larson with us, along with Jackie Steele from London, and also Chris Coran from Bowling Green, Tom Wine from Louisville, and this is Stephen. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. It's a wonder to see you fellas from Bowling Green. There was a boy kicked my doors in a couple of years back, and we spoke before to Ray Larson on a Friday morning. But there should be, like, they finally got him in Ball County. After they let him out of Fayette, he stole a checkbook from a school teacher down in Garrett County, and he finally got a year for that offense in Ball County for a $1,000 check. But he wrote a check in Warren County up in E-Town, and I think it was Bowling Green and Edmondson County. But he's sitting down in Casey County Jail right now serving a year on a plea deal. How do we go about being sure he's prosecuted in the other counties?
Well, this is what you call a nonviolent property offense, and he's no telling how many thousand dollars he's gotten. And for example, you got a case in Bowling Green, you got a case in Hardin County, you got a case in the other places said.
Right.
And what happens then is typically, if the guy's been convicted of something, they frankly will just, you know, move on to the next case, because we all have lots and lots and lots of cases. So,
Chris,
you know, the one good thing though that's helped in the last couple of years is the advent of the e-warrant system. Now most of the state is on e-warrants, where when a defendant does go into the Fayette County Jail, if I've got a warrant outstanding for him, when Fayette County goes to release, he'll be automatically held. That e-warrant can be served by the Fayette County Jail, even though it's a Warren County warrant. We're notified, and then we have to make the decision then whether or not and how to prosecute that individual that's had multiple county warrants.
Mm. Stephen, thanks.
Thank you.
One of the things that came up at one of our business meetings that we have for the prosecutorial system in general was that we have a fund that was created in 1998, Jack. It's called the Victim Witness Protection Fund, and money was allocated in 1998 to fund protection for victims and witnesses, and we're about out of money. And I'll give you an example. We prosecuted a guy named Shane Ragland here in Lexington, and we were very fearful for the life of the woman that testified against him, and we moved her around the country. And in order to do that, it cost money, and we asked for and spent about $20,000 from this fund, and it was done, and we're about out of money. We asked for money from the legislature recently, the prosecutors did, and were turned down. We're going to ask again, but that's a significant concern that we have, and that is the ability to keep people willing to testify in cases. I know in Detroit they have a 10% clearance rate on murders. 10%.
That's pitiful.
Yeah, well, it is. People are getting away with murder in Detroit.
Yeah.
And that's arrests. Now, you think about trying to get people to come to testify in Detroit. It's awful. Now, I subscribed to the Louisville newspaper, and I saw where some guy...
And you don't care for it much either, by the way.
Courier's Journal?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what happens is some guy that was to testify against a big-time drug guy and gang, I guess, was shot and killed. He came back to town. He just decided he wasn't going to continue to be protected, and he decided he's going to come back to town and take his chances. Well, he got killed. Tom, what are you seeing in that whole arena of witness protection, witness testifying, that sort of thing?
Yeah, we've seen a number of those, Jack, that individual was a witness to a murder, and a couple of years later, she was prepared to testify. And just before the trial, she's sitting in a busy park on a Sunday afternoon. A 16-year-old comes up, shoots her multiple times, takes off running. We had probably a half a dozen to nine witnesses who saw it, who gave statements. And when it came time for the trial of the individual who shot our witness, every one of them backed up, said they didn't tell the police what they told them, they didn't see anything. We were successful, though, because we had statements, and we were able to impeach him with those statements, and we convicted the individual. He got 55 years. But, you know, the problem we have is it's not direct threats. It's not like the defendant or his brother goes up and threatens somebody. Somebody just walks up and says, you know, the word on the street is if you testify, you're going to get killed. So people don't want to testify. And the individual that Ray's referring to was actually in the federal witness protection program. Had been moved out of the state to two different states. Didn't do well because you're totally taken out of your element, away from your friends and family. They ended up moving him back to E-Town. And from E-Town, he decided to come home and visit with his friends. So the people that shot him didn't have to go looking for him. He walked right into their hands. So there's a certain amount of self-protection. But Ray's right. The program was set up with $250,000. We're down to about $19,000. And by comparison, the Federal Witness Protection Program over the last 10 years, my recollection is, has had over $52 million. So we're just a drop in the bucket, what we're asking for.
Jim, good morning. You're on the air.
Thank you. Hi. One component that you guys were talking about with the nonviolent and even violent crime, I'm an attorney, but the constant that I see in all these criminal actions and even some that aren't criminal is the drugs. And I do dependency and neglect and abuse cases. I'm appointed from time to time. I would have to say close to 99% of those cases involves either drugs or alcohol dependency, but primarily drugs. And I'm seeing this growing. It's so prevalent in small towns now. It used to be the bastion of family and community values. And the one thing that I don't know if there's ever going to be a solution to it, but about 50 or so years ago, the mobster Lucky Luciano had testified as to how he thought you could stop drugs. And it's an interesting, although probably wouldn't work, concept. But he said that the only way you're going to get it done is to control the drugs by having a clinic where people will come and get their drugs for free, which would take the profit out of it for the criminal element. And then you gradually reduce the amount of drugs that they get. You test them to make sure they're not getting it outside of the controlled clinic. And then eventually you wean them off. In the meantime, you've taken all the money away from the people that are selling it. And he said that would be the only way he could see to destroy the proliferation of drugs. Of course, again, that was like around 1960. And it's so prevalent now, it's just so pervasive in our community, I don't know that even something like that would work. But I'd like to have some ideas on how do we stop this just rampant drug use and drug-related crimes.
Gentlemen?
Well, first let me introduce you to the Mexican drug cartels, Jim. So you go ahead and come up with the game plan on how to do this distribution of drugs through a clinic and slowly wean people off. But there's always going to be a black market for this, and so that's going to be difficult. Now, Jackie, you had some thoughts.
Yeah, let me say this. I agree with him in that I did looked at just my indictments in Laurel Knox County about 2 years ago, and we were able to say just by the face of the indictment and the criminal history that somewhere around 75% to 80% were drug or alcohol related. Now, that it was probably somewhere in excess of 90% because you have somebody not paying child support. You may not know they're a drug or, you know, a drug addict or an alcoholic until later, and they say, well, I need help because I can't pay my child support because I'm buying booze all the time. So it was really in excess of 90% was what our drug and alcohol problem related to in our criminal justice system. There's two fallacies in his statement regarding opening the markets up. If he's not familiar with, I can show him Suboxone and methadone clinics, which hand this stuff out on a daily basis, and it doesn't work. The reason is because you're giving a drug addict, you're supplementing one drug for another drug, but you still have a drug addict who is going to abuse the drug to get more and more and more. They're not going to take it the way they're supposed to. As far as opening the markets up, you know, I can give you plenty of case studies of pill mills that will give you any, that would have given you 5-6 years ago, giving you any amount of pain medication you wanted, but it will never be enough if you got a drug addict.
We have to take a break. I'll let you comment, Tom, when we come back. 2:05, 253-5959, touch star 590 from AT&T, toll free from anywhere, 1-877-777-0590, or email jackpatty@wvlkam.com. So far this morning, we've heard about creepers, crawlers, and tweakers. Kind of interesting. Sound like a cartoon.
Now, how about some perverts?
Yeah, now. Okay. Now, before we do that, though, Tom, I promised you a chance.
Well, the only thing I was going to say, the last caller talked about figuring out some sort of government handout program on drugs and that might help the problem. And I appreciate where he's coming from. But, you know, alcohol, tobacco, pill, prescription medication are all controlled by the government. They're all abused. There's black markets on every one of them. If somebody wants to get high and they can't get the level of high that they want, they're going to go to the black market. We're still going to have the problem. We got to get to them young before they start and educate our kids about the danger of these drugs. And that's where the legislature needs to put its money. That's what House Bill 463, that was all this revamping of our drug programs, promised to do, and we need to do that. We cannot wait until they become an addict to try to treat them.
Chris Coran in the break talking about child pornography. This one makes me real sick. I mean, I don't even like to hear about it. We got 3 minutes. How much of a problem is it in your area?
Well, you know, statewide it's huge, and nationally it's huge. One of the important things at our conference every year is we're update on the latest technology trends. And it's amazing. A lot of stuff we can't mention on the radio. What we're seeing, it is a multi-billion-dollar industry worldwide. We've got a lot of units. I know Lexington has one, Louisville does, as well as Bowling Green, working with ICAC, which is Internet Crimes Against Children, NCMEC, which is the National Missing and Exploited Children Group. When they save one of these children that's been used in child pornography manufacturing, the destruction to the kid's life is staggering. Plus, we've got certain images that become known as a known quantity, and you can see where they've spread to over 100 countries across the world.
And this is one example of serious crime that isn't linked to drugs and alcohol.
Right. This is one of the very rare instances where it's not a drug and alcohol crime. This is truly a sickness. Crime. It's a crime of perversion.
Nonviolent, though.
Up until a few years ago, possession of child porn in the Commonwealth of Kentucky was a misdemeanor. And the world expert on this issue is a guy from Oxford University in England, and he has said there is no cure for this addiction.
James, about 2 minutes, real quick, sir. James? All right, Ray.
Well, the real concern we have is that people that commit serious crimes need to suffer consequences. You know, we all grew up with the idea that if you break the rules, you suffer consequences. That's the way almost everybody was raised. And right now, we're getting away from that. And I deal with the public that is really concerned about it. I was at Kroger the other day and just in there going getting a loaf of bread, and some woman came up and said she really, her son was arrested for heroin possession, and she said, please keep him in jail, please keep him in jail, or he's going to kill himself, overdose. And I said, well, unfortunately, he's not going to be, because we're busy trying to get everybody out. And she just started sobbing right there in front of me, and I'm sitting here looking around. Everybody's looking at me. What have I done to this woman? And, you know, unfortunately, that's the issue. And I'm about to believe that the best treatment is going to be while people are in custody, because they get dried out, and then you can start dealing with them. But if you send them out to do it themselves, it's not going to happen. Chris?
Well, I can't tell you how many times I've seen parents whose child has overdosed on drugs that have looked at us and said, the first night's sleep I've had in years was after my child passed.
Oh, yeah.
Because they said, every night I never knew, are they going to be in jail? What are they doing? and just it destroys families.
Guys, thanks for being with us.